Good morning, everyone. And we have a full panel. And the voting members this morning will be Mr. Curry, Mr. Joya, Mr. Risley, Mr. Maston, Mr. Smith, Mr. Wood, Ms. Dillon, and Ms. Friedman. And so I volunteered Ms. Therese to be the one thrown out of the boat, since Ms. Friedman has been so diligent in coming to all our meetings, and this is the first one she has an opportunity to vote on. So with that, and since I'm sure there's no one in the audience that has any item that's not on the agenda, we will move directly get the right sheet of paper here, for the report items. Mr. Dossie, I presume.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Planning Commission. It's nice to see all your smiling faces. Before I launch into this and confuse myself and lose track of where I'm at, I just want to wish you all a very Merry Christmas, and if I don't see you, have a very Happy New Year as well. I'm going to go through the exec summary first, if I could get the overhead. We have a very lengthy Board of County Commissioner summary, so I'd rather spend more time on that than the exec summary. Maybe. There we go. Can we zoom in a little bit, please? That's good. So I think about halfway through the year, I was projecting that we would end up somewhere in the neighborhood of where we were last year in terms of the type C's and D's, and again, these are our major development applications. I think where we're actually going to end up is really more consistent with the year 2015. We're going to be a little bit below where we were 2016. Uh-oh. Are you guys seeing that too? Okay. Mm-hmm. Try that again. There we go. But if you'll notice, both 2014 and 2015 were about in that 250, 260 mark. I think that's really where we're going to be this year and probably moving into next year. I think what we saw this year is a lot of high-level projects. I think next year you're going to see a lot of final plats and prelims that come from some of those high-level projects. We also track, just as a summary, and I plan on doing kind of a year-end summary after the first of the year. I do that for the Board of County Commissioners as well, and apparently we're having problems here, but I'll just finish what I have here. We also track our type A's and B's, which, if you recall, those are our front counter applications. Compared to last year, we are actually ahead of where we were. We're about 200 below, where we were last year for the type A's. And those are the ones that are done literally over-the-counter, real-time review. We also are actually slightly ahead of where we were last year for the type B's. Those are ones that may involve an inspector going out and looking at an access permit, those kind of things. So we're pretty consistent where we were last year with the type A's and B's. And what you're going to see is you've seen a lot of final plats this year, but you're going to see even more next year. A lot of the staff reports I'm reviewing now are final plats. Those will all result in type A and B applications. So I think those numbers are probably trending up as well. You all have the Board of County Commissioners action report in the passageways backup? Okay. I just want to go down that list really quick. I'm going to skip ahead. I'll talk about the Land Development Code amendments last. The exemption for Security Water District, that was not an item that goes to the Planning Commission, so you did not see that, but it was approved unanimously by the board, 5-0. We're also seeing a lot of extensions to final plats that were approved but not recorded. If you look at the dates on some of these, they're 05. That means that was the year that they came in, so these are very old final plats. We're really at a point now, some of them, where Some of them may need to expire. Ultimately, that's a decision the board's going to have to make. If you recall, the board, those of you who have been around for a while, the Board of County Commissioners, as a result of the recession, passed a resolution that effectively extended a lot of final plats. In some cases, they were already expired, but they got thrown into the bucket and got extended. And so a lot of those plats have sat on the books in terms of approval, but not yet recorded for, you know, 15, maybe even longer years. That's kind of what we're dealing with now, and we're at a point where development has kind of regained traction, and so I think it's incumbent upon the board to evaluate whether or not some of these are ever going to happen, or if we just keep kicking the can down the road. So with the next one that we take, we're going to have that conversation with the board rather than just putting it on a consent calendar, actually have that discussion if it's something they want to continue to entertain. Because what happens is these final plats were approved under certain standards and regulations, not only from the land development code perspective, but also from the engineering criteria manual perspective. And a lot of those standards have been updated. And so there's an interest, or at least an inquiry by staff as to whether or not we should continue to honor those old designs, or for the sake of safety, we should force them to come back in and basically redo what they've already done. You know, after 15 years, it's kind of like something's got to give, you know, because development is gaining traction. The next one is the variance for the Murdoch auto repair.
Excuse me. Call. Yeah. Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Yes. Mr. Joya.
On that, is there any talk about possibly putting something into the code saying that there will be an automatic time period after which it'll expire?
There's already by notation in the staff report that we give 2 years for final plats. And again, a lot of those expired, and the board resolution essentially made them, reactivated them for approval. So, you know, it was intentional. We gave them a very clear list of which ones those would affect. But some of them are really out in areas where development just hasn't put pressure on the land yet. So. The Murdoch auto repair, if you recall, you all heard that. I think that your last hearing that was heard by the Board of County Commissioners. As a result of your hearing and a lack of opposition, we went ahead and just put that as a consent item for the Board of County Commissioners, and they approved it unanimously. I'm going to skip Silverado for a second. The bulk of what you all saw, I believe about a month ago, and what the Board of County Commissioners packets represented, which were something like this, and each one of them was toting it into the auditorium, which I guess was proud of them for toting it in there, but it was a lot of paper, was the Santa Fe Springs county-initiated rezonings. There was two people that spoke in opposition. Neither owned land within Santa Fe Springs at the Board of County Commissioners. One had a suspicion that the county was rezoning it to A35 only to allow for another wind farm to come in. I can tell you with great conviction that that is not the case. We have heard no mention of an additional wind farm. And if you recall, those of you that were here when we the wind farm came through the process, the wind resource map that the state of Colorado puts out did not identify that particular area, which, if you recall, is just east of Falcon, as really a viable resource area. You really need to be further north and east to get into that area. So I think the board disposed of those issues fairly quickly and ultimately approved that unanimously 5-0. And I did thank the board because, if you recall, we're talking about 6,000 some odd acres that were essentially sterilized. So I think the recommendation of the Planning Commission and ultimately the decision by the board were very wise decisions. And it's a big deal for those property owners that are involved in that. That was a very big deal. So I thank you for taking the action you did, and then ultimately the board taking their action. Going back to Silverado Ranch. If you recall, the Planning Commission approved that. That was a PUD preliminary plan, combined plan, and it was an amendment to the previous one. And if you recall, we had a lot of discussion here at the Planning Commission about the addition of equestrian uses and whether or not that was a major change to the PUD, adding the equestrian center, as a use, which was not allowed, and then also the waiver request to allow the first phase to be gravel, and then after that needing to pave the roads. But I think the biggest one was, and I think, Mr. Risley, you asked me the question, you know, why is adding equestrian a major change? The way it turned out, the Board of County Commissioners, is they saw that as a significant change. As a matter of fact, that was what I interpreted as a reason for denial. A lot of the neighbors showed up and expressed a lot of concern about being able to house 40 horses on that tract. You know, there's some discussion as to how that maybe could have been better presented by the applicant, but at the end of the day, the Board of County Commissioners certainly sided with the neighbors in finding that adding that equestrian use was not appropriate on that amount of acreage. Any questions on that one? Okay. Going back to the Land Development Code amendments, the cleanup. If you recall, you all approved that unanimously. The Board of County Commissioners approved that unanimously. One thing I pointed out to them is in the county's strategic plan, one of the goals for that really applies to our department is to update our regulations and try to modernize them. And I think that was one of those instances where we're trying to at least hold to that policy. The enforcement procedures for code enforcement, those were also approved unanimously. That was really a completion of other resolutions the board had already approved. And then finally, the tiny house amendments. I think I even said it here, Commissioner Vanderwerf is a very huge component of, or proponent of, tiny homes. They ended up doing a media day last Friday here at RDC. There were actually two tiny homes that were brought onto the site and parked on the south side of the building. A lot of media coverage. Unfortunately, they asked me to get up and speak, which is never a good thing for anybody. But ultimately, the board approved that 5-0. There were, I'd say, probably a dozen folks that got up and spoke that were excited about the opportunity. One of the things I keep saying is I think this is just kind of the start. I think our regulations will adapt over time, and probably the industry will adapt over time in terms of what they're producing. But we are getting a lot of, I would say, nationwide acknowledgement for what we've done. I think some cases good and bad, but I think certainly the industry is very optimistic about what we've done and are asking that Commissioner Vanderwerf be involved, not only at the state level, but also nationwide on what we've done. So we're getting notoriety. We'll see how it all shakes out. But again, I think our regulations are going to have to be organic as the industry develops and as we begin to see maybe some growth in that area.
I do have one question on that. Is there any interest in the industry to essentially go to a set of standards for RVs or tiny homes or water park models, whatever you want to call them, that are intended to be used as a permanent residence?
There is. The way that they're looking at it, well, I shouldn't say they, because I obviously can't speak for all of them, but the ones that I've spoke to, particularly the local folks, is they're looking at either the residential building code and being held to that standard, or the ANSI RVIA. Obviously, some of the manufacturers are already certified the ANSI RVIA standard, but they're actually starting the conversation, trying to initiate that conversation with the state and saying, look, we want to make these quality homes, but you don't have regulations that really fit. We're kind of that gray area between permanent, mobile, you know, so I think they're really driving that conversation. I think what the commissioners did by approving the regulations that we drafted is really, maybe it will force that conversation a little bit more with the state and maybe even with the federal government. But, you know, what I've heard from a lot of other counties, not just in Colorado, but in other areas of the country, is their zoning is really what's getting in the way of it. It's not really the building standards as much as their local zoning issues. I felt like we kind of overcame those fairly easily for all intents and purposes. But I do think that additional conversation needs to happen with the state. The Department of Local Affairs for the state of Colorado their attitude is somewhat in indifference towards tiny homes. They would really, I think, prefer to see the local jurisdictions regulate it. Maybe they did assume we take the risk there. But I think something's going to have to be done at the state level in order to kind of make it, you know, something that at least establishes a minimum threshold across all counties and across all municipalities. But and maybe that'll happen. I think it probably will. I think it's going to, the issue is going to get forced enough that it'll probably happen.
Yeah, the reason I asked the question is the big uncertainty that I had, and I voted for it, but Mr. Risley voted against it, I think, for very good reasons, in sure. The fact that we have a structure that is intended to be for people to live in it on a permanent basis, but we have no assurances that that interior has been manufactured or tested or certified that it's safe as a permanent residence.
Right.
And it seems like it'd be in the interest of the industry if they would mark out or carve out the RVs that are park models or ones that can not have its own water supply in a tank and its own gray water tank, and those would be manufactured to a with a little different process,
yeah,
that could be certified. I think it would be their benefit to do that.
Yeah, and I think obviously that was the thing that we struggled with the most, in addition to the mobility factor. Going across jurisdictional boundaries obviously creates a lot of issues, as we discussed with you all. So again, I think our regulations are going to have to be somewhat organic, and who knows, mm-hmm. We might be back in front of you again within a year or two to fine tune them. Hopefully not to completely undo it, because I think that would probably identify that it was a failure. I don't think it'll be a failure, but I do think we'll probably have to fine tune it as time goes on.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions for me on any of the Board of County Commissioner report items? Okay. Well, again, Merry Christmas, and feel free to contact me if you have any questions moving forward. I do know that we will have a meeting on January 2nd. We will have two consent items and two regular items. So I will see you right after the new year. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we will move to a regular item, since the consent item has been removed, and that's LDC. What? The minutes. Thank you. Thank you. Has everyone had an opportunity to read through the minutes?
Yes.
Does anyone have any changes to be made? Hearing none, of the minutes will be approved as presented. Now we'll go to our regular item.
Could I get the computer, please? Nina Reese with Planning and Community Development for the Vehicle Land Use Amendment. This is LDC 17-004. Our team consists of myself and Mindy Madden. So these amendments that you'll be hearing today are about vehicles. More specifically, it's about parking, storing, and repair of vehicles and machines. With the exception of just the general reorganization of the regulations, all of these amendments were brought up as a result of difficulties that code enforcement encountered when enforcing our current land development code. So now Lori Siegel will give you an overview of the review criteria.
Thank
Morning, Commissioners. The statute that is in front of you on the screen is actually the statute that gives you the authority to amend your zoning regulations. However, it does not provide any criteria by which you should do so. This is a legislative action, so it is completely within your discretion to adopt these regulations or not as you see fit, so long as you don't violate the Constitution in doing so. That's basically your only criteria today. Thank you.
Thank you.
So for the first revision, it's just general reorganization of the regulations. So in Chapter 5 of the Land Development Code, we have our accessory uses chart, and it lists storage and repair of vehicles and machines as an allowed accessory use in just about every single zoning district. It also says that it's subject to use-specific standards and that a site development plan is required. This has not been our practice. So the way that we have previously interpreted the code is that this is for repair of your own personal vehicles and not for any kind of commercial purpose. So we have not included any kind of definition to clarify that in the Land Development Code, and there also are not any use-specific standards within the Land Development Code. So the first proposed amendment is to relocate all of the regulations that are found in Chapter 6 pertaining to vehicle storage to Chapter 5, and in moving it, we will recategorize those items and separate it out so that you can clearly define the vehicle and machine repair personal from commercial so that there won't be any kind of discrepancy in enforcing the regulations. So in addition
to, I have one question about that. Is there any interest in enforcing quasi-commercial vehicle repair, particularly in residential areas?
Are you talking about a home occupation?
Yeah, probably a sort of a backyard mechanic kind of thing.
So we will get to that in our presentation, but okay. There already is a mechanism in the Land Development Code to allow for what we call a rural home occupation,
right,
of auto repair.
Okay.
So that is allowed, so we'll get to that. And
thank
then
you.
If we get there and we haven't answered your question, please let me know.
Okay, thank you.
So in addition to just relocating the regulations to Chapter 5, there are some minor modifications that we're proposing. So that'll be amending parking within the right-of-way, adding occupancy of vehicles prohibited, amending the inoperable vehicles and vehicle parts, and adding vehicle and machine repair. So Mindy will be covering the first three, and I'll cover the last one of those bullets.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
Current regulations prohibit vehicles with a gross vehicle weight rating of 13,001 pounds to be parked, stored, or kept in a residential zone, on private property, or in the right-of-way. The issue is code enforcement staff cannot run plates to determine ownership of vehicles and cannot write citations for traffic violations. So this amendment will just remove the language within the right-of-way. Everything else will stay the same. We'll still regulate prohibited vehicles parked on private property. Additionally, some changes are being considered to address the prohibited vehicles in the right-of-way and the engineering criteria manual instead of the Land Development Code.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Joya.
You said that basically parking in the right-of-way, that becomes a traffic violation, so that's why it'll be taken out?
Correct.
Okay. Do you happen to know off the top of your head if that is a traffic violation currently?
If the vehicle is not parked illegally and it's current on registration, the Sheriff's Department, I'm not going to speak on their behalf, but typically they won't do anything on that. So that's why we're looking at addressing that in the engineering criteria manual. Occupancy of vehicles prohibited. This includes regular vehicles and recreational vehicles. Now, this will not affect recreational vehicles that are occupied under a temporary housing permit or occupied RVs that are in the RVP district or anything regulated under the tiny home changes. So currently code enforcement, we get over 50 complaints a year. Just this year alone, we got 50 complaints on occupied RVs. This picture is a typical situation that we come across on a regular basis. When we issue a notice violation, we're doing that under the violation or the under the definition of a dwelling unit, which excludes recreational vehicles. And then we use the temporary housing language that says you can only live in an RV with a temporary housing permit and act a building permit to construct your permanent dwelling. So this amendment will add a specific language to address vehicles used for long-term occupancy. Any questions on that?
I had one. I've noticed in the press that there's interest and excitement and discussion about parking in the right-of-way and living there or sleeping overnight or whatever. And there's a big concern, it seems, or by some people at least, where, you know, that sort of addresses the homeless issue. And I also have read that the sheriff's office says we're going to enforce that. And the sheriff enforcing it, how does that relate to the land use rules?
So the sheriff's department would enforce on people living in vehicles on the right-of-way. Mm-hmm. This will address and allow code enforcement to enforce on occupied vehicles parked on private property.
Okay.
So there was some recent changes to the camping in the right-of-way resolution that allows the sheriff's department to have a little more enforcement abilities about occupied vehicles in the right-of-way.
All right.
Does that answer your question?
I think it does.
Okay. So the Land Development Code currently prohibits inoperable vehicles in all zoning districts, residential zoning districts, except the A35 zoning district. The way the code reads is inoperable vehicles are not allowed in these zone districts except in the A35 or as part of a rural home occupation. A rural home occupation limits it to 10 inoperable vehicles. So the way that reads is you can have as many inoperable vehicles as you want in an A35 zone district unless you have a business, and then we're going to limit you to 10. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So we're taking out basically the word or. So it says inoperable vehicles are only allowed in the A35 zone district in conjunction or as part of a rural home occupation. So that'll make it consistent with the other zoning districts, but still allow for people in the A35 zone district with a rural home occupation to have 10 inoperables. And that kind of comes in to play with the vehicle repair, which is allowed in the A35 zone district.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Risley.
I'm just curious, do you have a sense of how many properties would be impacted by that change? My sense is it's significant, but...
Just off the top of my head, I can at least identify 20. And these are ones that don't have a rural home occupation. So it will create some nonconformity doing this change.
So what's the county's position then, assuming that we move forward with this change? Would you then go and try to enforce on those 20-plus properties that you're aware of?
We are complaint-driven.
Yeah.
So if we do receive a complaint, and we deal with nonconformity issues on a regular basis, so we do our research, you know, pull up past aerials to try to determine whether or not they do have a nonconforming use. This picture, this is out east, and he does have a vehicle repair business. And he does have a non-conforming use because he has way more than 10. So that's a kind of a good example. Does that answer your question?
It does. And the reason I ask is that you know, these properties are a tremendous eyesore around the county, but also acknowledging that if we move forward with this revision, we would be putting some significant burden perhaps on the property owners to clean up their properties, which probably isn't a bad thing for the county in general, but just acknowledging that we'll be creating a burden for some property owners. So.
Right.
Yes.
One question I haven't looked into. Do we have a definition of junkyard for versus like vehicle repair? And where does it cross the line between vehicle repair and junkyard?
That's included in our salvage yard definition. So with the vehicle repair business, again, this, they're limited to 10 inoperable vehicles, but we don't have, you know, you can have 30 vehicles in a salvage yard. We don't have any of those. So it's really a case-by-case basis on exactly what's occurring on that property.
Yeah, would the people that are essentially operating like this now, would they have the ability to apply for a salvage yard permit to be able to keep the vehicles on their property? Because what I'm looking at is if you have a person who's, they've been on this property for 30 years, 40 years, and now the rules change and somebody files a complaint and it's something they've been doing for this long, do they have the ability to go out and go, hey, under this rule, under the new rule, you're essentially violating it, but you can apply for a salvage yard permit potentially?
Well, they could apply, but this would be a legal non-conforming use. So he wouldn't have to change his property to conform to the current regulations. So this particular case, he's not conforming because when he established this business, zoning wasn't in effect out in that part of the county. He did expand the area of his property that he stored all these vehicles after zoning came into effect. So we are requiring him to remove any vehicles that are in that illegal expansion area, but he can still continue to operate as he has for the last 30 years. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Okay.
I think it is. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Is this particular example, do they have a salvage yard? Are they zoned and have the authorization from a land use viewpoint to have a salvage yard?
He's not considered a salvage yard because he's been operating this way prior to zoning. So he does have a vehicle repair garage, but we're not regulating him to the 10 inoperable vehicles because he's had this many for 30 plus years.
Okay, so you are...
So if this were to occur today with the current regulations already in effect, we would consider this a salvage yard.
All right. But to a certain extent, you're grandfathering them in?
He has a legal nonconforming use, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for me?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Curry.
One relative to the parking of vehicles, we're limiting to two associated with a rural home occupation. Is that part of yours?
Right.
I'll wait. Thank you.
I'll just skip around. So let me cover that first since that question just came up. We have our residential home occupations and our rural home occupations. So these are two different categories of home occupations and they have very different allowances. So under the rural home occupation, this is for a more large scale operation. It allows for outside storage. It allows for some more intensive uses as well, such as the auto repair, which is what you guys had asked about previously. And then we have our residential home occupations. A residential home occupation is an allowed use within all of the residential zones, and it's for a small-scale business. So think about somebody that might have people coming to their home for tutoring. They might just do office work out of their house. It's very small-scale, and the intent is that this type of home occupation will be compatible and will maintain the residential character of the overall neighborhood. Within the land development code, we have many restrictions for the residential home occupation, but we don't include any kind of restriction on the number of vehicles that you can have associated with this type of home occupation. So because of that, code enforcement receives complaints fairly often on residential home occupations that there's an excessive number of vehicles associated with the home occupation. But because they might be meeting every other aspect that we're aware of, there is no violation in place. But as you can see from this picture, having an excessive number of vehicles on a property definitely does disrupt the compatibility and makes it very difficult for you to maintain the residential character of the neighborhood as well. So what we're proposing is to limit the number of vehicles associated with the residential home occupation to 2 vehicles. So this would exclude customers, because you're allowed to have customers come on site. This would be purely for the business. So are there any questions on the residential home occupation and the number of vehicles?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Ms. Dillon.
This is a little bit to the side of this, but is there any limit to the number of vehicles a resident can have, like on a regular lot?
There is not.
So
it only, yes, this would only apply to their vehicles associated with the business.
Yeah. So that, but nowhere in the code is there any
nowhere.
They can have,
if you have a very large family and you have 5 cars, that's perfectly fine. So this wouldn't be taking away any of their existing rights. It would just be limiting the impact of their business to the neighborhood.
It destroys the residential character when the whole yard is full of automobiles.
Yeah.
Let me follow up on that and make sure I understand it. Let's say there's a couple that both work and they each have an automobile. And then they happen to have some kids that go to high school. And each of the high school kids have their own car. And maybe there's one who's going to college locally. So you could very easily find that one residence with 5 cars permanently parked around there, and that would not be a violation?
It would not, okay. Because those are vehicles that would typically be incidental to a residence.
Mm-hmm.
What we're trying to prevent is that a home starts to look like a storefront with many, many work vehicles in the front.
Okay, all right. But not to discriminate against large families.
No,
with lots of kids.
We still like large families. So.
Okay, good. Thank you. Did you have a question, Mr. Curry?
Yes. And you've answered a couple of them. So the one that I have remaining, I think, on this is relative to recreational vehicles on residential properties. Where are the restrictions on that? Because I didn't see them in the code here, and certainly in any of the changes. Are there any restrictions on parking of RVs and motorhomes on residential properties like there are in a city?
There's not. So as long as you're not living in them, you can park them anywhere on your property. Now, there could be HOA covenants that the
right.
county
yep.
doesn't enforce,
yep.
but there's nowhere in the land development code that says you have to have them screened or behind a fence, or you can't have them on your property.
Oh, okay. And then at some point, we can do it afterwards. There's a typo in the purely administrative typo. I'll
oh,
get
good.
You guys'
Thank you.
Attention.
We'll
so appreciate we can do that afterwards.
Okay.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Yes, Ms. Friedman.
I just have a question about.
Do you want to turn your microphone on, please? Oh.
Maybe I'm just not loud enough.
I can hear you, but it doesn't sound like it's coming through the mic.
Is it coming through? Yeah. I was just curious as to whether there's a definition for these industrial commercial vehicles and how you would, what you're going to use to determine that these vehicles meet those criteria instead of being, you know, quote, personal vehicles that happen to have 3 sheets of glass in the back or whatever.
We chose not to put any kind of definition into this set of revisions just because we didn't feel that we could really capture everything that could potentially come up. So obviously, if you have a vehicle like that, the ones pictured, and you've got your company logo on it, well, that's a work vehicle. If you have a vehicle that has all of your work equipment in the back of it, that's going to be a work vehicle. If it's a somewhat of a heavy vehicle, not a typical residential vehicle, then that's going to be a work vehicle. So it'll have to be up to the discretion of the code enforcement officer and ultimately up to the director on what we consider work versus residential. So because we didn't want to be too restrictive, we didn't add any kind of definition in there. But I think we would all agree that in most cases, you can look at a vehicle and tell, well, that's only for your business, or maybe this one you might use as a commuter vehicle as well.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I do have one follow-up.
Mr. Curry.
Thank you. It's very quick. These rules apply only to the unincorporated part, or does it also apply to the city?
All of our regulations only apply to unincorporated El Paso County.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any more questions on the home occupation before moving on? Okay. So a very minor change is reorganizing and recategorizing the vehicle and machine repair so that it is clearly separate from the personal repair. So if you look at the proposed amendments, we have the personal repair versus the commercial repair. So we've added a definition as well in this instance so that we can look at both Chapter 1 and Chapter 5 and be able to distinguish a commercial business from you repairing your own personal vehicle on your property. And I've already covered that. So are there any questions about any of the proposed revisions?
I'm not seeing any.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Craig Dossey, Planning Community Development again. I wanted to clarify something. You used the word salvage yard, and I don't want there to be anybody listening to this at any point that thinks that some of the pictures that you've seen and some of the properties out there will be grandfathered in as salvage yards. Just because somebody's storing inoperable vehicles on their property doesn't make it a salvage yard. If it's not a commercial operation, it is not a salvage yard. It is their own personal inoperable vehicles that they're storing on their property. The reason why I say that, if I could get the overhead, I want to show you why that's significant under the code. Assuming our camera works. And I can walk you through it anyway, but I can talk through it. If you look at the use table, salvage yards are only allowed in two zone districts. That's the I-3 and the M. And I-3 will tell you that that is a heavy industrial zone district. And the M is an obsolete heavy industrial zone district. And the reason why I bring that up is salvage yards have a lot of negative impacts associated with them. So I don't want anybody to think that just because you're storing your own inoperable vehicles, you have a salvage yard by right out there moving forward. Because if you'll notice, even in those two zone districts, it still requires approval of a special use. So we are very conservative as to the allowance for a salvage yard. Further to that point, we have use-specific standards that deal with salvage yards. Specifically, it addresses things like the environmental impacts, storage of fluids from the vehicles, deals with fire, parts removal and storage, landscaping, screening, fencing, very lengthy regulations. So again, to hammer home the point, just because you have inoperable vehicles on your property out east or wherever, and our regulations are changing, it does not give you a quote-unquote salvage yard. If they want to come into commercial operation and sell parts off those vehicles, they would have to go through the same process as a brand new operation that is on a vacant piece of property. I wanted to highlight that because salvage yards are a very sensitive issue, not only in neighborhoods, but also even in commercial areas. Very high traffic, and obviously from an environmental standpoint, fire departments are very keen on salvage yards. Obviously, there's huge fire potential there. So it's important that I put that on the record that it does not give you a salvage yard by right. Any questions on that?
Thank you.
Thank you. other questions in general?
At this time, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Gioia.
In regards, regular item number 3, LDC-17-004, El Paso County Land Development Code Amendment concerning vehicles. I move for approval under the new standard resolution, page 7.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
Second from Mr. Curry. Right?
Yes.
All right. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the roll. Mr. Curry?
Aye.
Mr. Gioia?
Aye.
Mr. Risley?
Aye.
Mr. Maston?
Aye.
Mr. Smith?
Aye.
Mr. Wood?
Aye.
Ms. Dillon?
Aye.
Ms. Freeman?
Aye.
And the chair votes aye. So this action is approved unanimously.
Thank you, Planning Commission. One other item before you all leave. I think this is our only item, so we dispose of that pretty quickly. Every year we try to do sort of a kind of end of year luncheon with all of you. This year I kind of chose not to do it during Christmas and New Year's because we all got a million other things going on. But I was curious as to what the desire would be to do it on January 2nd. That is your next meeting. I think there's a good likelihood that the two regular items that you will see probably could carry you towards the lunch hour, if not all the way to the lunch hour. Certainly we could plan for it maybe a little bit early, 11 o'clock or so. I don't know what everybody's feeling on that would be, but that's certainly something we would like to do for you.
Yes.
Lots of thumbs up. Either that or they're telling us we're number one. I can't tell if they're thumbs or fingers.
Well, let okay. me
No,
let
it's
me
called
put it
free
this way.
Food.
Free food.
Does anyone have an objection?
To free food? Please, tell me. Please tell me.
Or would you like to reschedule your free food?
I don't know yet if we'll have one on the 16th, but I do know we'll have one on the 2nd. And we're all going to be full as ticks from Christmas and New Year's probably, but once you get rid of that, we'll fill you up again, I guess.
So. The 12 days of Christmas.
Okay, well, we will plan for it on January 2nd.
We have a straw poll that says yes.
Thank you.
I think we're finished, and we are adjourned.